Good morning, everybody. If you'll please find our seats. On behalf of Torah in Motion, I want to welcome everybody to what promises to be an exciting day and a high-level scholarly, day of investigation in the Rambam. Who is the Rambam? What do we even call him? The Rambam or Maimonides? Was he mainly a philosopher of Judaism, a medical doctor, a codifier of Jewish law? Was the Rambam a revolutionary, perhaps a quote-unquote a reformer, bringing new interpretations of God, of mitzvot, of our relationship to God, to our understanding of Torah, by changing all the rules? Or perhaps, was he a staunch traditionalist who was very willing to write outside the pale of Judaism those who did not live up to our beliefs, our practices? Who was this most complex and most important of personalities in the last couple thousands of years? I think everybody here is in the room knows there's been no greater person who has influenced the course of Jewish law and Jewish thought than the Rambam and Maimonides, and then really in observance of his 800th Yahrzeit, which I think is actually coming up in a week or so. I don't remember the exact Hebrew date. But the observance of the 800th Yahrzeit of the Rambam, we have gathered four outstanding scholars on the Rambam, and each one is going to give a talk, and then at 2:15 we're going to have them all get together in a panel, and some of the issues that the questions that may arise from the talks and beyond, we'll have an opportunity at 2:15 to go over them. So we'll get started. We start with our own host city. I don't know if that's the exact interpretation, but our first speaker, Dr. Jimmy Diamond, who began his career as a lawyer and has moved in the field of Jewish studies and is a professor, holds the Joseph and Wolf Lubavitch Chair of Jewish Studies at the University of Waterloo. He has published on the Rambam. This is his field of expertise. He's working on a new book on the Rambam. And it's a pleasure, we're honored to have a scholar within our midst, and it's an honor for me to introduce Dr. Jimmy Diamond.
Thanks, Rabbi Kelman. It's a very gratifying to see the crowd that turned up. I figured I had three strikes against me. Sunday morning, 9:30, cost some money. We're all Jewish, of course. And I'm the warm-up act, but it's nice to see. What I wanted to talk about today, the title of the lecture is Discovery and Rediscovery of Judaism, Maimonides on Abraham and Moses. A few prefatory remarks before I get into the meat of the lecture, and that is a few statements that Maimonides made. And then what I want to do is, after I've quoted these statements, talk about where did this man come from? What brought him to make these kinds of statements? And what kind of broad vision does he have of Judaism in general? So if you look at the beginning of his Guide to the Perplexed, which is his philosophical magnum opus, he says, I'm addressing... This is interesting, who the audience is that he has in mind when he's writing this book. And that is those who have really an existential problem. And the existential problem is as follows. That is, they are good rabbis, they're very well versed in the rabbinic tradition, and they're very well versed in the philosophical tradition of its time, the science of its time. And they have a lot of problems. Sound familiar? They have a lot of problems how to put the two worlds together. And he says they're left with two choices. Before I came on the scene, they really are left with two choices. One is that they can reject, really, the tradition and remain faithful to their intellects, or remain faithful to the tradition and really, in a sense, and this is not his words, live a lie. That is, live a lie. Remain faithful to the tradition, kind of compartmentalize their intellects, set it aside, and say, you know what, I'm going to be consistent with my upbringing, but it's kind of living a false life, as Sartre would say, living in bad faith. And then he goes on in his introduction. That's one quote I'd like you to keep in mind. Then he has another introduction to one of his works, one of his introductions, actually, to Pirkei Avot, where he says a very interesting thing. He says, in this introduction to Pirkei Avot, Chapters of Our Fathers, I'm going to say a lot of things that are actually, that actually have already been said, that are quotes, but I'm not going to mention the names of those people who I'm citing. It'll seem to you as if this is part of my own thesis. But he warns you that that's what I'm going to do. And he says the reason is, A, this is the very famous statement, that I subscribe to the belief that one learns the truth from whatever source it is. That is, it doesn't matter what the source of the truth is. If it's truth, it's truth. But second, the reason I won't mention the names is because there's a great sickness in our world today. That is, people tend to judge the content of a statement, the truth content of a statement, by its author. That is, if its author is some guy who doesn't believe in a lot of the things you believe in, if its author doesn't subscribe to divine providence, doesn't subscribe to a creator of the world out of nothing, then we tend to dismiss the content, the statement that he made, because of his character or because of the beliefs he has. And that's wrong, he says. What you have to do is subject the statement and scrutinize it for its truth content on its own, without any relationship to who the person was. And he says that's the problem. If I cite the name of the guy, in particular guys like Aristotle, right, who have rejected pretty well everything that Jews think Judaism stands for, then you'll reject the statement. And that's not what I'm about. So, forgive me for that. I know I'm transgressing a couple of rabbinic statements in terms of one must quote in the name of who he hears the quote from, but there's an urgent situation here, and I need to resort to this kind of tactic. the third thing that I really want you to bear in mind is the Mor Nebuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, again, his philosophical magnum opus, is written in a kind of, it's not written really as a book, it's written really as a private correspondence. It's kind of a long letter, a series of letters, to a beloved student of his, a beloved disciple of his, Joseph, who had moved away. He no longer has the opportunity for face-to-face meetings with his student, and therefore, probably realizing his own mortality, realizing that students aren't always around in the classroom, he has to write books, or he has to write something down, otherwise this isn't going to last. But the qualifications of this student are quite fascinating. That is, this is obviously the person that he means this book for, and knowing that written works will tend to get into the public forum, he understands also that when I describe Joseph, I think, I'm describing the audience that I want this letter, if anybody's going to eavesdrop on this letter, this is the audience that I want to listen to this letter, or this is the audience that I think will understand this very long letter. So he writes to Joseph, he has a little introduction, and he talks about what moved him to write to Joseph, what moved him to compose this work, was really Joseph's personality. The traits that he saw in Joseph moved him, again, not necessarily intellectually, but here we have a little bit of, I think, of emotion as well. Here we have the Rambam as a person, not simply as Dr. Spock. But he says, you have a strong desire for inquiry. I'm not interested in people who don't have, who aren't bothered. That is, if you're not bothered, fine. Don't worry about it. But he has a strong desire for inquiry, a longing for speculative matters. That is, he has this innate, not just innate, we'll come to see, but this developed curiosity for things that go beyond the empirical world, necessarily. Things for reflection, for philosophy. He is, in fact, also, he's enticed by his writing style, because he says, your letters reached me, and I was impressed by the rhymed prose. So he likes his writing. This is somebody who is articulate, not just a thinker, but he's articulate as well. He has mastered mathematics, logic, astronomy. He says, you are familiar with the philosophical schools of the day, with the Islamic philosophical schools of the day, the Mutakallimun. So therefore, you are up on all the literature that's out there. And his purpose in this is really, the way I look at this book, is to, going back to that original audience that he addressed, is, I know you have this problem. I know we can't learn anymore. We don't have that chavrusaship that we used to have together. And I know you have problems still with the Torah, with the Tanakh, with how I can live with this tradition and live with all these disciplines that I've mastered. How can I live with the two? How can I go on living with the two and be comfortable and be fulfilled, and be fulfilled spiritually? So, with that in mind, what I wanted to do was discuss really one piece, and I'm a believer that really when people talk generally about somebody, you don't come away with much. But if you look at a text and you look at something the person, the thinker actually wrote, and kind of look at it very carefully in a very close reading, you come away with a lot more. So, where does this man come from? Where does somebody like Maimonides, Rambam, come from that he has really raised a group of disciples like Joseph, who are masters of the rabbinic tradition and masters of the science of their day, of the philosophy of their day? One who can say, learn the truth from whatever its source, no matter who says it. Where's he coming from? What's the vision? What's the general, broad vision that he has of Judaism? I think there could be no better source in his writings than, oddly enough, maybe not so oddly enough, really the Mishneh Torah. Not the Morne Buchim, but his halachic work. His code of law. And there he describes the origins, really, the foundation, the discovery of Judaism, as the title of the lecture reflects. The original, initial discovery of Judaism by Abraham. So what I'd like you to do, there was a handout, is take a look at that handout, and I'm sorry, I tried to get as many sources in one page as I could. They're numbered. For those of you who haven't gone to yeshiva, you won't be used to reading things that are minuscule. I'm paying for it now. I have to take off my glasses when I read this, but I thought it would be better than having papers fly all around the place. In the beginning of the laws of Hilchot Avodat Zarah, the laws of idolatry, you don't get what you expect. And often in the Mishneh Torah, you arrive at passages that don't specifically give you law, legislation. This is a code of law, after all. As people before me, as the great Professor Isidore Twersky has shown, a large chapter in his book, the book Mishneh Torah is also a weave of philosophy and law. And here is a very a prime example of that. That is, the entire first chapter of Hilchot Avodat Zarah, the entire first chapter, has no law in it. No law at all. It is an introduction, a preface, to the laws about idolatry. So therefore, one assumes that if this is a preface to the laws of idolatry, that I'm going to understand now what all the laws against idolatry, because that's really what most of the laws are taken up with, what really is the philosophical principle that underlies, that is the foundation of the law. And this is extremely important for the Rambam. Extremely important for the Rambam because of those quotes that I gave you in the beginning. That is, the Rambam is interested in people who have mastered the rabbinic tradition, who have a longing for speculative matters, who are interested in the truth. And therefore, he is interested in those who can see the larger picture, those who can see what underlies the mitzvot, what lies behind, what principles really inform the mitzvot. And here is a very, very interesting example of that. And it's interesting because it is the foundation and the discovery. My assumption is that if this is the discovery, then this is really where he captures what the essence of Judaism is. This is what I say. I mean, I'm open to people arguing. This is I've said it before. This is the people have said this. There is Maimonides, your Maimonides, his Maimonides. So I am sure everything I say here, there will probably be at least 60 different opinions here, even though there are only 59 people here. So bear with me. For Maimonides, I've skipped a little bit of a piece here, but his theory of history, really, as opposed to other philosophical theories of history, other modern theories of history, scientific theories of history, is not, if you were to graph it, if you were to chart it, is not a straight line going straight up. Or, that's in the scientific world. It's also not, as opposed to many who think in the traditional world, those who follow the maxim, let's say, Hitkatnu Hadorot, that there is a decline in the generations, it's also not the chart. If I were to chart, doesn't follow that either. That chart would follow, that graph would follow a line going straight down. That is, we, at the farther we move away from Adam, from Avraham, from Moses at Sinai, the smaller we get. That's not really his vision. His vision is really more, his theory of history, if you were to call it that, is really more peaks and valleys, up and down. You start with the very peak. You start with Adam. Adam lives in a world, and this I'm drawing on what he says in The Garden of the Perplexed, Adam lives in the world of pure truth. There's not enough time here to go into what that means, but he is not interested in things that are not universal truths, truths that hold for everybody for all time. He is only interested in that. He is not interested in things that fluctuate. Law, societal norms, ethics that are based in subjective ideas. He's not interested. Adam is not interested in that at all. He's not interested in that at all. He's only interested in those things that hold for all men for all time. And that's why he says he's only involved in the world of emet vasheker, truth and falsehood, as opposed to the thing he ate from, which gave him the knowledge of tov v'ra, good and evil, and those things fluctuate. Those things are contingent on history. Those things are not the subject of his humanity. So that he started off with the perfect, the true idea of God, monotheism. After Adam, I'll quickly run past Adam, you get to the generation of Enosh, you get to two generations later, Enosh. And by the way, I'm not going to mention here, but Maimonides, whenever he says things here, be assured that he is picking up on something in the rabbinic tradition. It's not like he is actually saying something so radical and totally sui generis, but he does really always have something to hang his hat on. It may not be the thing that most people out there think is the accepted opinion. But very often he does have a basis, though he won't. So he's notorious for not mentioning his sources in the Mishnah Torah. In this piece, there are very many things that I'm sure you will see that he has a basis for. But he gives it a little bit of a twist. So you have a deterioration from the time Adam died, a deterioration in the idea of monotheism. But it doesn't start off immediately as idolatry. It starts off as an error. An error. That is, Enosh, in the time of Enosh, they look, who's Adam's grandson, and he's picking up on a verse, Az huchal lekro b'shem Hashem. I invite you to look up the Midrashim, Rashi, what happened there. Az huchal, then they started to call in the name of God. Midrash has Lashon Chulin. They started really to profane the name of God, started to call everything in the name of God. Rambam picks up a little bit on that and says they made an error. The error was that when they saw bodies, things in nature that really govern their lives, by which every moment in their lives are regulated, they started to think and reflect. It's an error. It's not a bad thing. It's not that these were immoral people. But there's an error in their thought, and they think, you know what? God must have had some reason to put these things up there, and they're so prominent in their lives, they play such an important role in our daily lives, that maybe God really wants us to use these as intermediaries to get to Him. So you have the idea, already you have something interposed between God and man. There is something, an obstacle in a way. They've introduced an obstacle. That God put these things in it, so there is still the idea of God, there is still, strictly speaking, monotheism, but there's an intermediary. There's another way to get to God. And they believe this was God's will, the one God's will. Eventually what happens is this deteriorates further as you go on. And this is interesting, by the way. You have to listen to the words, Kevin she'archu yamin, that is, after a long time. And this is consistent with Maimonides' view of not only history, but Maimonides' view of human nature. That is, things don't happen like that. Never. God never even makes things happen like that when it comes to human nature. Human nature, by definition, doesn't change from one instant to the next. So when he says, Kevan she'archu, right, once a long time had passed, you get into another phase of deterioration, he is picking up on a maxim that governed a lot of his philosophy, Olam kiminhago noheg. Also in the rabbinic tradition, though I think he gives it a little bit of a twist, the world goes its customary way. Though God can change it, it is possible to change it. He doesn't. That's Maimonides' position. He doesn't. It's possible, but he doesn't. Human nature evolves naturally. So therefore, this historical description of the deterioration of thought evolves naturally. And I'm going to go quickly through this. It deteriorates to the point where God becomes completely lost in the equation, no more God, and then these things become entities in themselves. That is, intermediary imposed, an obstacle, but then the intermediary cuts off the source from the people. And then the intermediary becomes a thing in itself, an end in itself, due largely to the hijacking of religion by imposters. If I were to give this Lahavdil Marxist interpretation, long before Marx ever came on the scene, Rambam is very explicitly describing here that idolatry was a religion that was the opiate of the masses. That's what the Kozvim, the deceivers, the Nevi'e Sheker, false prophets, used for their own benefits. They exploited religion, the clerics exploited idolatry for their own purposes. Now we get to Avraham. So this thing went on and on. It deteriorated terribly to the point almost of no return. Then you have number one, the source here. And I just wanted to go through this and look at the language, because the model here that he's posing is the model, I think, that informs all of Judaism. The Judaism that we practice today, the Judaism of the Torah Mi-Sinai, must be informed, otherwise I don't know why he would spend so much time on this, must be informed by the model of Abraham. Supplemented by further models, but first and foremost by the model of Abraham. And then we'll understand how it is that the Rambam can say those things I said at the beginning. Once this man, this Abraham, grew up, he says, "Hitchil l'shotet b'dato." He began to reflect, to roam around the world. His mind went wild, just wild. That's the way I would describe it. But Hukatan, he was yet young. He started to reflect day and night. Vahayatameya. He wondered. This picks up on, of course, the Greeks, Aristotle, Plato. All philosophy begins in one very important thing. In wonder. Begins in wonder. That is, Joseph's longing for speculative matters is very much rooted in this model he is posing of Abraham. Joseph is the Abraham he is talking to. He has seen Abraham in Joseph. That is, if you don't wonder, if you don't look at the world and wonder, then I'm not interested in you. I'm really not interested in you at all. That's a little harsh. But for effect, I'll say it. And then he started to wonder, and these are classic arguments for the existence of God, I won't go into them, about the world, about the movement of the heavenly bodies. And what he did was, he arrived at the existence of God, at the truth. And then what he did is, note what he did after he arrived at this truth. He didn't come and ride through the Middle East on his camel with his sword, right? And say, if you don't accept this God, the one God, we'll slice your head off. Right? Look what he did. Look what Avraham did. Once he understood this, hitchil hashiv tshuvot. He started to engage in debate, to respond, to raise doubts, all kinds of translations of this, but to plant the seeds of doubt in those that surrounded him. That's how you start, right? That's how you start. If these people aren't wondering, then you make them wonder. These are the people in Ur Kustom, people in his community. The Larachdini Mahim. Once he planted seeds of doubt, then Larachdin, the modern Hebrew word for lawyer, is Orechdin. Right? Maybe Maimonides didn't believe that you should kill all the lawyers. But you begin to engage them again. You parry with them. Right? You debate them. You plant the seeds of the doubt. You encourage discussion. And you debate. Now, you do engage in a bit of violence. You do engage in a bit of violence. Because once he does this, and he's established an audience, and people are interested, and they're talking, and they're discussing, Shiber Hatzlamim. Of course, everybody here knows he's picking up on the Midrashic tradition. He broke the idols. Okay, so probably what my mind is saying, understanding human nature, is to understand that the force of an argument maybe doesn't go so far. You need also to remove the focus of their error. And then I'll have to resort to violence. Not violence against the person. Not physical violence. But I'm going to have to destroy their churches. I have to. I just can't take this, right? As long as these idols are around, these figures, this is going to distract people. So let's get that out of the way and engage in pure debate. Pure one-on-one. Don't let these things distract you. Don't let the clerics distract you. Don't let this opiate distract you. I know you like it. You feel comfortable. Let's get it all out of the way, clean slate, and discuss one-on-one. One-on-one. Tell me. You think idolatry is that? Okay, I'll tell you. And if you're convinced, stay where you are. But if you're convinced by me, then you come over to my side. The truth. Then what he does is, I'm skipping ahead. If you notice the lines, I've kind of underlined. He tells them, "Ein roi laboid el hailoilam." He says, no other power is worthy of worship except this God. This monotheistic idea that I've introduced is worthy of worship. Now, if you look at source 7 there, this is kind of a parallel passage in the guide that I think he had in mind when he wrote this. That is, I'm not going to read it, but Abraham, one of the tactics that he had was, in order to counter the mode of worship, the cultic form of idolatry, he used a subversive tactic. That is, I understand that people have a need for prayer. People have a need to focus and direct and ask and supplicate and beg God for attention, for gifts, to guard them, to protect them. But what I want to do, I'm not really interested in that so much. What I want to do is want to subvert the notion of idolatry and get them back on the right track. So what he does, and this is problematic in terms of his source in the rabbinic tradition, Abraham establishes the western direction, okay, as the, if you look at the, source 7, the direction, and he's in Israel, so he's directing it towards the west of prayer to counter the sun worship. That is the sun. If we're talking about the evolution of idolatry, and we're talking about this prominent display of these heavenly bodies, they're worshiping towards the east. That's the sun. So in order to subvert that, there actually is no significance in direction. There is no significance in direction. Because God, of course, is the one God. God is truth. Truth is universal. Truth is everywhere. It's out there. It doesn't matter where you direct your tefillah. But for the sake of subverting idolatry, you turn it around. And Moses picks up on this later on. God and Moses pick up on this. But you turn it around and you say, no. The sun is not the focus of our attention. It's another direction. That's what he does. He doesn't actually fix and standardize and institutionalize. He does it by model, by teaching. Then what happens is, as always, when religion is always connected to politics, always. We see it today. This has always been the case, though people have not been able to make the distinction so clearly. Now we do in the modern period. But in the ancient period, there was never this kind of clear distinction. But religion is always connected to politics. When Abraham spreads the truth, Lahavdil, the gospel, he gets in trouble with the authorities because he becomes politically subversive, because religion has been hijacked by the powers that be. Religion is political because of those kozvim, those deceivers, as in the V.A. Sheker, who don't believe in it at all, but are using it for their own personal benefit, including the governmental regime that exists. They exist because they're feeding the masses this stuff that makes them happy, that allows them to stay in power when Abraham feeds them the truth that attacks and subverts and undermines their political power. So if you notice, the next thing I have on, like, Kaven Shisha Gavar Lehem Barayotav, once he is succeeding and gathering converts, so to speak, we're not talking about literal converts, and this is important, this distinction between converts to Judaism, so to say, and what, so to speak, and what Abraham is doing, Bikesh HaMelech Lahargo. The king wants to kill him. Right? The king wants to kill him. The king's not interested in the truth. The king's interested in power. In power. Right? So, religion is simply a means to assert his power. So what happens? Nathilones, he's picking up a pure court midrash, whatever the case may be. That he was thrown into the Kipshana Esh, into the fire by Nimrod. By the way, Ness can be read in very different ways. In fact, one who was a great opponent of the Ramban, who revered him but was his opponent on very many matters, says on this that the Ness doesn't necessarily have to be. You can choose what you want. It can be a Ness Nister, that is, a Ness that happens in a kind of a natural way, and that is the king, for some reason, decided to spare him and sent him into exile. Or you can believe in the hit over your head Midrash tradition, which is he threw him into the fire, into the furnace, and he came out alive. Whatever you want, you can choose. So when you read Ness here, you can choose what you want. You can choose which source you want. Whatever you feel comfortable with. And then when he enters into exile, he's in exile. By the way, some of my students from my former class were here. It seems to me that he's picking up on a model, consciously or subconsciously, not exactly, but we're describing somebody here also in the Greek tradition, Socrates. Socrates, who went around, really was a political subversive, paid for it with his life. The only difference, I would say, is that we Jews are more practical than the Greeks. That is, Socrates, when given the choice, Socrates had the choice to escape. He could have, I suppose. His friends, he had friends in high places. He could have escaped. He chose to die for his principles. I'm going to take the poison, the hemlock, and die. I don't care. Avram, Jews are more practical. You know what? I got a truth to teach. I'm not going to sit here and let the king kill me. I'm fine here in my parochial community, but there's a whole world out there that needs me. They need me. So when I weigh on the balance, yes, it's fine to be a martyr. It's fine to martyr yourself. I'll let other people do that. I got a job to do. I have a job to do, which is the truth. The majority of the world don't subscribe to this truth. I'm going to bring it to them. So he goes on, and he's in exile, and Modia l'kol achad v'chad, I'll skip over a little bit, kefi dato. He uses the perfect pedagogical method. He again engages in debate, but teaches everybody according to Chanocha Anor Lefi Darko, right? That is, he follows the, maybe that a lot of our schools don't follow today, you teach a child according to his own space. You understand his space. This is something I think that educators, I think in particular nowadays, do not understand. And that there is only one space, and that space is a very narrow space. And in fact, that space where those people that these educators gear everything to, maybe those people should be in another space, because those people are going to end up good no matter what. It's the space that goes out of the normal space that we have to address. It's the, what he says here, Hayamodil kol achad v'chad kefi dato. Abraham was the supreme pedagogue. So there's a pedagogical lesson here as well. Then what he does is as Rambam did himself, as the Rambam did with Mishnah Torah, with the Mor Nevuchim. I mean, he doesn't have to write a book for himself. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. What does he have to write a book for? It's just taking him away, right? But Abraham realizes and acknowledges his own mortality. He realizes that I'm going to be gone. The Chiber Sfarim. He starts to compose books. He writes books. The Hodiel Yitzchak Beno. And he appoints a successor. Okay, let me skip a little bit. Now we get to, we've reached another peak. There was a peak, Adam, a valley, until Abraham. Then another peak with Abraham. Now we deteriorate to the point where in Mitzrayim, he says, Abraham's idea that he brought to the world almost got lost, completely cut off, uprooted. Therefore, I think what the Rambam is saying, that Abraham's strategy wasn't successful. It wasn't able to preserve this truth for all time. A new strategy. A new strategy needs to come onto the scene. Moshe comes onto the scene with a new strategy. Not Avraham's strategy anymore. The new strategy is Moshe Rabbeinu, Kevin Shinit Nabe Moshe, Ubachar Hashem Yisrael Anachla, Hichtiran B'mitzvot. Now you have a new strategy. This goes together, by the way, with I don't know. It's all a mess to be here. But anyways, one of the sources here, where Abraham, the difference between Abraham and Moses was that Abraham never said to anybody, I have a law to give you. I have a law to give you. That is, Abraham simply spoke the truth. People were convinced by the truth, but he never said, God told me to tell you that I have a law. Now that's interesting. The reason I think he said that is because Abraham is living in a time when that's precisely what's being done by the false prophets. The false prophets are saying, God told me that you should serve this idol. I have a direct message from this star for you to establish this cult dedicated to this star. So for Avram to be successful, he has to subvert totally that philosophy. So therefore, he cannot have the same strategy. I don't bring you a law. I'm not like those guys. I bring you the truth. Unfortunately, human nature, Olam Kmin Hagonoheg, doesn't allow for that. Hundreds of years pass. We get into another serious crisis, a juncture in history when Judaism might be lost, and we get to Moshe, and a new strategy comes on the scene, law. Law? Hodiyam derech avodato. There are standardized now ways of serving God. Mishpat, and he tells them, Mayye mishpat avodazara. What will be the sanctions, threats, sanctions, punishment? That is, Moshe understands that this no longer works, right? This has to be supplemented. And it's supplemented with the law, with sanctions. I often wondered about this word hichtiran. I don't have much more time, but to get to the 14 sources that I had here, I thought for some reason I could get to it. But anyways, that is, hichtiran is a very unusual word, and I'm sure hopefully there are people here that can tell me, there are people here that are much greater Talmudic scholars than I. You know who you are. I talk to you all the time. There are people here that are greater Maimonides scholars than I. But the word hichtiran, I did a search, not that I'm a great genius, I did a search in the CD-ROM and found that this is the only time that this word is used in this grammatical form, that is a hifil, I believe, hichtiran, right, from the word keter, which could mean a bunch of things. But as I thought, you know, my own drush. I like the drush a little bit. I like the darshan a little bit. That is hichtiran, and I didn't find this grammatical form in any rabbinic tradition either. Hichtiran b'mitzvot means that there is law. That is, Moshe is no longer convincing people or persuading people solely by the truth of his position. He needs aids. Maybe that came out wrong. He needs supplementary strategies to preserve the truth. And that is law. That is law. But notice the difference. If you say that Keter is a crown, if it is a crown, he adorned them, he surrounded them with mitzvot, but if it is a crown, crowns, generally speaking, maybe the original guy is worthy of the crown, like David, let's say, or Aaron, who start the two crowns, Keter Melucha and Keter Kohuna. But generally, after that, once that is established, once the truth is established behind that crown, it's hereditary. It's hereditary. The truth is no longer dependent. That is, the truth of Kohuna or the truth of Melucha is simply passed over to the next guy in line, no matter who he is. So maybe that's what the Rambam is getting at here. That is, hichtiran b'mitzvot, doesn't necessarily address the truth of the situation. You need law. You need tradition. You need something that's passed down. And that preserves the kernel of truth that Abraham introduced. So it gets supplemented. Abraham introduces the truth, then it's clothed in law, and then I believe, because history works in a series of peaks and valleys, that Maimonides saw himself, Lahavdil, in a very similar role, and that's why he wrote the Mora Nevuchim and the Mishneh Torah. Both are strategies to address a crisis in his own time, merging law and philosophy. And so it is that these things don't usurp the previous. That is, each one builds upon itself. It doesn't mean that Moshe's strategy revokes Avram's strategy. It means that Moshe's strategy is supplementary to Avram's strategy. It increases and strengthens Avram's strategy because it preserves the kernel that Avram introduced. So I have a bunch of things here that, a bunch of sources in the halachic literature, in the Mishneh Torah, that kind of demonstrate this. But I'll just mention two things, I don't have much time left, just to show you how, that even once the Mosaic system has been introduced, the Rambam is very careful to preserve at crucial junctures in the Mishneh Torah the kernel, the truth, the thing that it's all about, the thing that we have a tendency to forget, not seeing the forest for the trees or the trees for the forest. I never understood that cliche, but anyways. So I just have a few examples. One. That is, that if you look the, at the last example, 14, at the very bottom of your sorry, 13. He talks about conversion. Conversion, oddly enough, comes in the halachot of Isurei Bia, of forbidden sexual relationships. And we won't go into that. But the laws of conversion are in that place. People have worked on the system, the order of the Mishneh Torah. That's not what I'm going to talk about, but simply to look at this for what it is. That is, when you look at this, this is chapter 14, Ketzad Mekablin Geri Tzedek, how do you, what procedure do you go through in order to welcome a ger? What is the formal procedure of conversion? The one thing I wanted to point you out to is he generally adopts the rabbinic sources, but there is a twist. There is a twist. And the twist is that he says something that the rabbinic sources do not have. Not only do the rabbinic sources not have, but he seems to make it the primary focus of conversion. And that is that. What do you do when he comes and you've contrived to dissuade him, and the, you know, the Jews are suffering and they're persecuted and all this stuff. Are you sure you want it? Yeah. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you what the content is of Judaism. The content is, Umodian, that's number two, Beit, Oto Ikre Hadat, Shehu Yichud Hashem, the Isur Avodah Zarah, Umarichin B'davar Zeh. This is not in the rabbinic sources. What's next is in the rabbinic sources. Umodin oto miktsat mitzvot kalot umiktsat mitzvot chamurot. You let him know about the commandments. You let him know about the law. But first, what Maimonides says, umarichin, what you dwell on at great length, is the ikre hadat, the Abrahamic legacy. The Mosaic legacy is what the rabbinic tradition really focuses on. The Rambam here is being very consistent with his original model of Abraham and, very appropriately, with Gerim. Because, of course, converts are exactly the people that are going through the very same process that Abraham went through. Jews, naturally born Jews, actually, very often, don't go through that same process. The ideal process. We're born into it. My parents were Jews. They came from Ungvar, right? They told me I'm a Jew. They sent me to Jewish schools, Eitz Chaim, right? Abraham, he makes a point, by the way, went to the U Ayin Aleph. He went to Ayin Zion. He went to the University of Avodah Zarah. He says in the Mishnah Torah, he says he had no Mesorah whatsoever. Sui generis. Absolutely from a clean slate. His father told him, this is the tradition our fathers followed. He went to the U of Avodah Zarah. He studied with the best of the idolatrous scholars. And he rejected tradition. So in fact, a model is the rejection of tradition. Because I have some sources here. Number four, a man does not, he talks about, number two, where he talks about Mesorah. He talks about tradition, that is traditional knowledge. On the scale, on the hierarchy of knowledge, Mesorah, that is acquiring knowledge on the basis of authority, my father told me and my grandfather told me, that's not nothing, that's important, obviously. But it is actually occupies a very low rung on the scale of knowledge. I actually have to, I would say, overcome that. It's almost an impediment. It's almost an impediment to the truth. Because I can never know something according to the Rambam, and there are many, many sources in the Morning Ruchim for this, and in various parts of Luke. I can never actually know something unless I've gone through the arduous effort of studying, reflecting, and knowing. Because if I know something only because somebody told me, or somebody in authority told me, then I have an imaginary belief. I don't really know it. I haven't assimilated. It's not true for me. It's not true for me. And the convert is the one who is actually going through what Abraham went through, in a sense. The convert is rejecting the tradition that he grew up in and coming to the truth because it's the truth. Oseh ha'emet, because it's the emet. He performs the truth because it is, not because Moshe said it, not because God said it. Not because Rav X said it, not because your father said it. In fact, you have to overcome it. So, what I wanted to just... Jay? Where are you? How many more minutes do I have? 5 more minutes. Okay. An hour I have? An hour? Okay. So, let me just take you to this idea that he actually... This is a code. Okay. So, one might say, it's a code. It's a code of law. You know, poiskim don't go strictly according to codes of law. Decisors, halachic decisors, you go to a rabbi. There's a lot more considerations that a rabbi has to take in, right? There's political considerations, right? There's this going on in the community, this going on out there. You don't go by the books. That's not a halachic decisor. That's the luxury of the academics who study in the yeshivot, who never have to actually deal with people. The guys who have to deal with people, I'm sure Jay can tell you about this, have to take a lot more things into consideration, and that is actually part of halachic decision making. I hope nobody tells you, halacha is not my bag, right? So after I gave a few talks in my shul, people started to ask me questions about halacha, and I said, hold on a second. You're getting something wrong here. That's not me, okay? I'm not a halachic decider. That's a whole different kettle of fish. It's a whole different ballgame. Right? If you want to tell me what the Rambam is talking about philosophically, maybe I can tell you. But halakha, forget about it. But one thing I know is that halakha decider has to take other things into consideration. He has to take human nature, the political situation, the community situation, all those things come into play. So we actually have this notion of the true descendants of Abraham are the converts. We have a letter that the Rambam wrote to a convert, probably a Muslim convert. A Muslim convert to Judaism. Now, you've got to understand, conversions in the Middle Ages, in the time of the Rambam, was not like a conversion today. Okay? Anybody can convert today. No big deal. Right? You may get a little bit of flack from your family. Nobody's going to tear your tongue out. Nobody's going to execute you. Especially when you're converting from the dominant religion, like Islam, let's say, or Christianity, whatever that may be, because Judaism, it'll never be Judaism, at least in the last couple of thousand years. That was never the dominant religion. So if you're converting to Judaism, you are converting from a dominant religion to a subservient religion, to a subjugated religion. That has serious, serious consequences. And therefore, probably the motivation would be because Oseh HaMet, because of the Emet. I'm converting here at great cost to my life because of the truth. You're the guy I want to talk to. Come here. And we have a letter from Ovadia Yosef, he's called, that wrote to the Rambam and said, I have a very serious existential problem again. How can I go on with the most prominent, pervasive ritual in Judaism, which is tefillah, prayer. Every 3 times a day, Shabbos, you know, holidays, it pervades more than I would say any other law, every aspect of my life, is ethnocentric. Ethnocentric, historiocentric. It talks about Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu, our fathers. Avram's not my father. Right? Asher etzisanu me'eretz Yisrael. My ancestors didn't leave Egypt. Asher nasan lanu was the Torah. My ancestors didn't get the Torah. Can I go on saying the tefillah? I mean, this is a very serious problem. This isn't a guy asking whether Wrigley's chewing gum is kosher or not. This is a guy who, at great cost to himself, at maybe very dire consequences, doesn't feel that he's been accepted. So the Rambam tells him, I won't go through the whole tshuva, but he goes on to show him how he is in fact the only true descendant of Avraham. That is, he is Mizaro Shel Avraham. If you look at source 14, this is part of the letter. Nimsa Avram Avinu Av. Now, note clearly, and the translations of this, I think, some of the translations have been wrong in conflating two things. But note what he says. Nimsa Avram Avinu. It turns out he's talking to the Ger, and he tells him, yes, of course you can say all these things. Why? Because the introduction that I gave you, this whole model of Avraham. Who else fits the model of Avraham except you? Who else fits the descendant of Abraham? Ben. We know Ben in the Brinic tradition, Ben in his own tradition. He often addressed his disciples as Beni, my son. My son means somebody who has assimilated my teachings. So of course you can say Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu. But look what he says. Nimsa Abraham, it turns out Abraham, our father, Av is the father of two things. Lizaro aksherim haolchim b'darchav. He is the father of his biological descendants. By the way, he's not just the father to his biological descendants. There's another condition. So if you think that just because you're born of a Jewish mother, halachically, I'm not saying that Maimonides would disagree with this, but philosophically, if you think that philosophically you're the descendant of Abraham, you're wrong, because he adds the following. Haolchim b'darchav. Who walk in his ways. And walk in his ways, you can go to the Mishnah Torah, open it up, and read the passage that we read, and find out what Avram's ways are. If you're not walking in his ways, you're not a descendant of him. But then, there is another category. The Av, and he's a father, l'talmidav. He's also a father to his disciples, to those who have learned from him. Behem, and they are ger, kol ger sheit gayer. They are every convert that converts. So I would just simply end off the way he ends off his letter. That is, in this letter, and I actually do not think that he's resorting to hyperbole. It's often called an egeret, a letter. It's a tshuva. This is a tshuva, the way Rav Moshe Feinstein would write a tshuva, the way any rabbi would write a tshuva. This is a tshuva about a halachic question. He's not being hyperbolic here. So he says at the end of the tshuva, he says that, Al tehe yichuska kal be'inecha. Don't let your lineage be kind of, don't minimize it. He says, because we, anachnu, right, mityachasim el Avram Yitzhak v'Yakov. We trace our lineage meaning us, our biological Jews, right? Trace our lineage back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But you, your yichus is greater. Ata mityaches lemish amar bahayaha olam. You, your yichus, your lineage, goes directly back to the one who spoke and the world came to be. And of course, this is perfectly consistent and perfectly logical. That is, in a sense, we, I hope, I don't know, there might be some of you who aren't, but we who are descendants, biological descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, actually, in a way, have to spend a lot of our time overcoming it, overcoming Mesorah, overcoming authority, and getting to Misha Amar Vahaya Olam by reflection, by the model of Abraham, by the model of starting with a clean slate and arriving at the truth, because the truth is the truth and for no other reason. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we don't have time now for questions. Like I mentioned earlier, at 2:15 and our panel, we'll have all the opportunity to ask questions to all of our speakers. We'll take a 4.5-minute break for coffee and cake, and we'll come back in 4 minutes and 23 seconds.